Well, the first, I'm sorry about running late. I do apologise, and I'm sorry that I missed the presentations from Nigel and from Geoffrey, and both of whom, of course, have made incredibly important contributions to this subject. With Nigel, Sir Nigel, having led the way with, particularly on open data and through his work at the Open Data Institute. And I believe that the presentation that you heard from Geoffrey, based on that excellent Royal Society publication, Science as an Open Enterprise, was, may I say, similar to the ones that we had for the G8 science ministers in this room. And it is quite correct that we have a practice run on the science ministers of the leading Western nations, and after it's been tested on them, it is then delivered to this foundation. That's the right set of priorities, and it was an excellent presentation in this very room for the G8 Science Summit, and made some very important points. Let me very briefly just review where we are, because I know I am late, and I apologise for that. There are, for us in the government, there are kind of three sort of levels of this which are worth separating out. One is sharing research findings and the regime for open access to publicly funded research. Behind that, there is the data on which the research findings rest. And perhaps most imaginative, and I'm going to be able to say at least about this, the role of the public in helping secure the data in the first place with, as you all know, some very interesting initiatives, be it Galaxy Zoo or my son's laptop helping out, he assured me overnight, on protein folding as part of a sort of science initiative. And in some ways, that's kind of citizen science, collecting the data and harnessing the wisdom of crowds to measure ash dieback or help in protein folding, I think is one of the most exciting areas. But that I've got least to say, and I thought I should focus on the two areas of most direct public policy, and that's first the open access to research findings and then the data. And on the research findings, which again, in various types of events, I've certainly spoken about in this very room before, the principle is very simple, that the public have a right of access to publicly funded research. And I still think of some of the frustrations I had writing my book as a layman outside the academic community on fairness between the generations, The Pinch, still available in all good bookshops in paperback, that quite often you wanted to track down something and you found it was behind a paywall. Now, of course, in a way, my book is behind a paywall, but the difference was that if that was research that the ESRC or someone had already financed out of general taxation, then at that point I thought that the constraint on access was unreasonable and unacceptable. And that's the basic principle that derives what we're doing, drawing very heavily on the excellent work of Janet Finch. We've managed to get an agreement between the research community and the publishers on a way forward, captured in the famous decision tree about the circumstances in which you have gold open access versus green open access. Gold open access, which I still prefer as the one with the greatest, I think, the sort of rustic integrity, that there is a cost to communicating research findings. We should recognise there is a cost, and part of research funding should include the cost of the communication of your research findings, and you should be explicit about that, which is gold. The other versions are green, in which the publishers are able to collect value for a time by having your work behind a paywall, but with a time limit, after which it is openly accessible. In addition to that, we're negotiating a national license for walk-in library access, so that I do think we are making real progress on open access, green and gold. What I worry about, to be honest, is people, and this is there's a hint of this in the EU agenda, who think you can just achieve all this with green rules, with quite short timescales before the research findings are available, because publishing does genuinely add value, and it's not totally clear that how academic publishing is a viable enterprise if you simply go for that version of green. You either need to have a longer time period or you need properly to recognise the costs in gold. So that's a sort of ongoing debate. And it's a debate we had in this very room a few weeks ago. But that's not the only thing that we're doing. There is also work underway in the research councils on their Gateway to Research, which is a single one-stop shop web portal that will enable people to get information about all the publicly funded research projects of the research councils. And the Gateway to Research is quite a simple utilitarian thing. It's not elaborate, and there may well be, as it's, I think it's in beta stage at the moment, and we hope it'll be fully functional by the end of the year. Then there'll be other people who'll come out with smart apps and ways of analysing this material in, to make it more immediately accessible, searchable in different ways. But we're getting that first portal in place. And we're also very committed, of course, to doing more on knowledge exchange. And after all, some of those controversies about impact in the ref, it's all about trying to get people to look out as to how what they're doing, the research they've done, has changed the world, what it's done that has had an impact on a wider environment. And I think we are making progress because of the excellent work of Janet Finch. What strikes me is how some of the internal tensions within universities are revealed when a policy like this comes along. And so, for example, I get told that the universities won't pay our article processing charges under gold. They won't. Why should they help us to publish our material? And you think, hang on, these are universities. If I was trying to run a university and I was telling my keen researchers I wasn't proposing to help meet the costs of their publishing their material, it wouldn't be a very good way of treating your academic community. And the fact people have these anxieties tells me that sometimes there's a bit of a disconnect between the academic community and university management. And that gets transmitted as an unhappiness about government policy, but it's really telling us of some deeper distrust, which I hope can be overcome. So that's the open access agenda. What I wanted to talk about a little bit more was open data, because that, I think, is trickier, and it's where there are even greater technical issues. And some of the technical issues are shared with open access to research findings, because incidentally, the stuff that's going to be made open access, it's very important that it be fully searchable, that people be able to use it and analyse it easily, and that requires quite a lot of technical work. I don't understand it, Nigel and Geoffrey will, but we haven't fully achieved that yet. But it's even more important that the data behind this research, as it's published, should itself be accessible. And I remember a conversation, a meeting at which was hosted at the Wellcome Trust, of the main funders of life sciences, the main public funders of life sciences research from the major Western countries. And as you were sitting there with the head of the National Institute of Health for the US and the German researchers and the funding body and everything, you thought kind of probably the people around that table had funded cancer research studies of 500,000 patients, 1 million patients. And behind every research paper published, there was an analysis of patients with cancer in a whole host of different ways. And the dream must surely be that at some point in the future, that incredible database should be available for analysis with all the capabilities that we're developing for taking very large data sets and identifying new patterns and meanings to them. That's really what we should aim at, that the data that's all been funded by the different agencies in advanced Western countries should all be publicly available. We're a long way from that, but that is the vision. And getting there is a complicated process. And it starts with a paradox, and I see Baroness O'Neill in the audience, and so it's a paradox which I associate particularly with her, that one of the anxieties we had, first of all, from the research community, was the application of the Freedom of Information Act to their research work. And would their lab notes be subject to FOI? And to what extent did a researcher have the kind of right of first publication of his or her data, and not be subject to an FOI request, which means it all had to be publicly available, before they had the first go at imposing some kind of order, some kind of intellectual narrative on this often confusing raw data. And we have committed, and she played a distinguished role in making this case, we have committed to applying what's called the Scottish exemption to the rest of the UK as well, so that that provides an exemption for researchers who've got data before they have, within a reasonable period, published it. And so, and that, and I pay tribute to her campaigning on that, and it's something where she shifted the government's thinking. So that's the paradox to start with. I then go further. There is, of course, the potential of text and data mining, and it's very important that that be, there'll be a legal framework to permit text and data mining. And draft legislation has been published on the website of the Intellectual Property Office for technical consultation on that. We need the infrastructure to handle these very large data sets, and that's why we are making substantial investments in high-performance computing, not just the hardware, but the software, the modelling, the simulation, so that we build up the capacity to handle very large data sets. The Square Kilometre Array, at run from Jodrell Bank, will be collecting, we hope, the data from 3,000 dishes in the from the deserts of South Africa and Australia. You need a massive investment in high-performance computing to handle those very large data sets. In fact, I'm told that the computers will need to be 1,000 times more powerful than they currently are to handle the data flows emerging from the Square Kilometre Array, which is as a flow of data greater than the current flow of data across the internet. But we're confident that by the time the dishes have been built, the magic of Moore's Law will have worked and we'll be able to do it. We'll be in deep trouble if we can't. We need to get the privacy regime right. That is another challenge, and it's particularly lively in health data. And the deeper you dig, the trickier it becomes, because, of course, people are entitled to confidentiality and anonymity. Are they entitled to kind of a complete opt-out from any use of their data, from any medical research? Those investigations of the possible links between cancer and the deaths of people living near power lines. Were people living near power lines entitled to opt out from their medical data about their condition being used in the analysis of the effects of power lines? It would have been a rather peculiar research project if you'd needed to consult every individual living near a power line before you put their data into the research. So actually, when you look, there are points when scientists do think they have an entitlement to use large data sets without going for individual consent. And how do you define that? So that's trickier when you look at it close up than it sounds when you start. There are security issues, and the where there is a much greater American interest in so-called DURC, dual-use research of concern, than in the UK. There are Americans who think that some of the biological research that we are publishing is as naive as publishing material on nuclear, how to generate a nuclear reaction in the 1940s would have been. They think that some of them think, and of course the arguments like the research into the H5N1 virus are a good example of that. So contrary to this picture you have of America just being the place for open access to everything, in my experience the Americans are much more willing than we are to think of potential military implications of this research and immediately say it should be kept private. They have a far more restrictive regime than us, but they think we are naively open sometimes in some of these areas, particularly life sciences. We need to think about skills and capabilities. It's great to talk about accessing all this data, but modern librarianship, the process of ensuring that this data is we have the capability to analyze it and we're collecting it in a form that is accessible, is a big challenge, and I'm not at all confident that we do have that capability. And we're trying to address these type of challenges in a group I chair called the Research Sector Transparency Board, and both Geoffrey and Nigel are members of that, where we really are trying to dig deep into the open data agenda, not just the open access agenda. And then, finally, as I said, after open access to research findings and after access to the data behind it, there is the citizen science agenda, which is very interesting, and the ability to harness the collection of data by citizens, be it through Galaxy Zoo or protein folding, I think is one of the most exciting developments in science communication. And it's a way in which people can really themselves feel that they participate in the scientific process. And if you have ideas about ways in which we can support or encourage that without killing it with too much kindness from government, I'd be very interested in that. So it's a very important agenda. I'm sorry I wasn't able to hear the earlier presentations, and I very much look forward to our discussion of it. Thank you very much indeed.